Good afternoon. Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 8th of May, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. Well, the US military on the move, and quite a lot of reports in the papers about this, a deployment of one of the largest US aircraft carriers. Going out to the Mediterranean with the headline, US deploys aircraft carrier bombers after credible threat from Iran. This is, of course, a Guardian headline, but this is a pretty major step of the Americans. Some of the reporting says, well, of course, this is a routine deployment, but there seems to be more to it. And what comes in with this article is this report here. We've chosen to go with RT, but it's also reported in other sources. US deploys four B-52 bombers in Middle East to counter purported Iran attack plan. So the headlines are clearly pointing a finger at Iran, Mike, and well, the Americans have got to do something. So let's just have a look at what Russia Today said. The Pentagon will reportedly station four B-52 heavy bombers in the Middle East in response to what the White House called a credible Iranian attack plan on Americans or US allies in the region. Two of the warplanes will leave from the Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana for Qatar on Tuesday, with another two joining them in coming weeks. So this is interesting stuff. But when we get into the Guardian article, this is the man that comes up, of course. It's John Bolton. He's also quoted with his sidekick, Patrick Shanahan, the acting defense secretary. And this is the statement from that Guardian article. The deployment of forces was first announced by the National Security Advisor John Bolton on Sunday and confirmed by the Acting Defence Secretary Patrick Shanahan on Monday. Neither official gave an explanation of the alleged Iranian threat. According to one report, information passed on by Israeli intelligence contributed to the US threat assessment. So now we've got the wonderful words coming in, Mike. We've got alleged, and we've got a source which appears to be from Israel, but no details printed anywhere of what this serious intelligence is suggesting that the Americans need to respond in this way. But it gets better. Quoted in the article was this gentleman, Ilan Goldenberg, and if you clicked on the active link the Guardian provided, it sent you through to this Twitter page and this particular tweet. A carrier into CENTCOM is not unusual and was likely routine and long planned. The inflammatory language from Bolton is unusual, provocative, but my guess is just an opportunity to try and intimidate the Iranians. Nothing more.
So this is how diplomacy is done these days, is it?
Quite extraordinary, Mike. We've got Mr. Bolton. He seems to be, on his own on this one to some extent, and we'll have to report more on it. But yes, this gentleman, Mr. Goldenberg, casually saying, well, don't worry, it's just the Americans shifting aircraft carriers around the world to intimidate nations based on alleged intelligence assessments, which allegedly seem to come from Israel.
We've been here before, haven't we?
I think we have, yeah. So I just couldn't resist dropping in one of our red labels on that. No worries, nothing to see, move on. It's just a bit of ordinary American intimidation of nations in the world. So unlike The Guardian, I thought it might be interesting to have a little look at Mr. Goldenberg. Because the Guardian seemed to be quite shy on this gentleman. So let's see what we can see. This is the organisation that he works for, which is the Centre for New American Security. It says he's a senior fellow and director of the Middle East Security Programme. He is a foreign policy and defence expert with extensive government experience covering Iran's nuclear programme, the Israeli-Palestine conflict and broader challenges facing the Middle East. So a lot to do with that, but we've got some more here. From 2012 to 13, he served as a senior professional staff member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, covering Middle East issues for Chairman Kerry and Menendez. And in that capacity, he acted as one of the lead drafters of the Syria Transition Support Act, which provided additional authorities to, quote, arm the Syrian opposition.
Terrorists.
So this would appear to be, yes, providing arms into the terrorists. And so the picture is now beginning to get quite interesting. Let's bring up a bit more. From 2009 to 2012, he served as a special advisor to the Middle East and then as the Iran team chief in the office of the Undersecretary for Defense. In that position, he provided advice and support to the Undersecretary of Defense policy and other senior Department of Defense officials on Iranian nuclear, military and political issues. And prior to that, he was one of the founding staff members of the National Security Network. We've got to do a little bit more on that organization. But don't worry, because it's a progressive non-profit foreign policy organization dedicated to a pragmatic and principled foreign policy. He spent his early years as a financial analyst at Citigroup Investment Bank. And this appears to be the theme as we dig deeper into this. We come nicely into the quagmire of big banking interest.
When we talk about a principled foreign policy, does that mean a foreign policy based on the principle of blowing everything up?
Well, I think we're going to see that a lot of money to be made out of war and death. This is one of the pages which appears to be advertising his particular work, Mr. Goldenberg's work. I found this a very interesting image. If anybody can help explain this one to me, I would just love to know. There's something cartoonish about these American servicemen and women, almost like toy soldiers. Of course, they're the ones out there going to die for policy coming from these organisations. Do have a look at it yourself. Obviously, go online, do the research yourself. But here we have Center for New American Security. Bold, innovative, bipartisan. That's reassuring. And it tells you a bit more. It's independent.
Ah.
Okay. Remember that. It's independent, bipartisan, non-profit organization that develops strong, pragmatic, principled national security and defense policy. It says here we have a track record of attracting the best and brightest scholars and practitioners to lead our research programs, and our board members, founders, leaders, scholars and interns have held or gone on to prominent positions in the US government. So it's hard to tell what you're looking at here, because these people are now embedded in the US government, the Department of Defense. So is defense policy in America being made as a result of a democratic process in the Senate or whatever, Mike? Or is this one of these think tanks that's actually driving the policy in the background?
Well, it seems like if you've managed to get your people recruited into positions of authority within an institution, and then those people that have been recruited into that institution will go back to your organisation for the policy suggestions. It seems like that's a pretty good way to control a nation's policy.
A nice little circle, isn't it? The snake eating its tail is probably a good image for this one. So what more can we tell you? Well, it gets better, because we need to have a look at some of the top men. We've got Neil Blue, CNAS Board of Advisor, Chairman and CEO from a company called General Atomics. What have we got to say? Well, he is CEO of General Atomics. General Atomics is a high technology company acquired from Chevron by the Blue family in 1986. It's got affiliated companies, GA Aeronautical Systems, of which Blue is founder and chairman, and GAASI produces, this is where it gets interesting, the Predator series of unmanned aircraft, as well as laser electro-optical radar and distributed intelligence systems. So we wanted to ask a question. Does anybody think that his business interests, including Predator drones, would increase in value as a result of tension and war in the Middle East? It's hard to say, isn't it?
Very, very difficult.
Very difficult. Well, we took a little bit more time to get a bit deeper into this organisation. And of course, a good place to go is to see where the money comes from. And I have to say, I was fascinated because in the big donors, $500,000 or more, the top one listed is the Heinz family. Now, I don't know whether they're also producing spaghetti rings and baked beans, possibly. But of course, we've also got the Open Society Foundations here. So this is George Soros putting big money into this organisation. And remember, it was Tory MP Johnny Mercer who said in his letter that he was quite relaxed, effectively, to see that George Soros was helping to formulate UK defence policy. So just remarkable. We've got Northrop. We've got all the big defence industries funding, but we've also got George Soros and the Heinz family. So let's have a look at a few more. Well, here we are. I've highlighted there the Airbus group, because this was another organisation which Johnny Mercer said it's fine, be relaxed, because Airbus are also in helping format defence policy. So who else have we got? Well, we can go in. We've got some big names now.
Well, there's BAE Systems, for example.
Well, American Express, you would hope to have a good credit card company in there. BAE Systems, Bank of America, BP America, the Bovin family, not sure whether they come in. And so it goes on. Japan Bank for International Cooperation, JP Morgan Chase. And if we come down here, this is interesting. NATO, Allied Command Transformation. Now, this is the part of NATO which says that it's assessing future threats and changing the whole of NATO policy to react to those. But my question is now, who's driving who? Is this NATO that's thinking for itself, or is it actually the Center for New American Security that's actually driving the policy coming in through NATO? It's very difficult to tell. But it got more difficult when we had a look at this one. It caught my eye, Morningstar Foundation. I thought, what could that be? And the answer is, I still don't know, because when I did a search on the internet, the only Morningstar Foundations I could find were all dealing with children and or poverty. And it puzzles me as to why we would have a children's charity putting money into this defence think tank. But unlike The Guardian, we've shown you a little bit more detail about the players in this wonderful system, which has ultimately ended up with the Americans sending an aircraft carrier to intimidate Iran. Let's have a look at what the Iranians had to say. Well, this is Mohammad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister. And with respect to the deployment, he said this: during a visit to New York last month, the Iranian foreign minister warns that what he called a B team consisting of Bolton, the Israeli prime minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the crown prince Mohammed bin Zayed, and his Saudi counterpart Mohammed bin Salman was seeking to, quote, goad the US and Iran into a conflict. Mm. Now, when you read those comments from the Iranians after seeing the detail of what's going on in the background, you tend to get a rather different impression as to what this man is saying. It sounds credible. It sounds sensible. He went on to say this: we don't believe that President Trump wants confrontation, but we know that there are people who are pushing for one. And he told that to the CBS program Face the Nation. He said, I think the US administration is putting things in place for accidents to happen. And there has to be extreme vigilance so that people who are planning this type of accident would not have their way. Now, of course, if there was an accident, we ended up with yet more war and bloodshed in the Middle East. Of course, the profits of those defence companies would certainly rise.
Well, it's interesting that he suggests that he doesn't believe that Trump wants confrontation. It's interesting that he's almost suggesting that there's a difference in approach between Trump and Bolton. And so maybe it's worthwhile just having a look at what Mike Pompeo has been up to, who's Secretary of State, of course. Well, he was meeting Lavrov just a couple of days ago. Following that meeting, Lavrov was asked some questions. He said, first of all, how many secretaries of state is this now, Foreign Minister Lavrov, that you've met with? And he said, I've stopped counting. And the question then was, well, after whom did you stop counting? And he just said long ago. But anyway, he said, we had a very good constructive conversation. We discussed many regional issues and we're on the current UN agenda and the international agenda more broadly. We discussed topics related to strategic stability. I think we took a fairly good step forward following up on the telephone conversation that took place between President of Russia, Vladimir Putin, and the US President Donald Trump several days ago. Well, that took place on the 3rd of May. And he said that preparations are being made for a follow-up meeting with Pompeo in Sochi, which take place on the 14th of May, and that would be announced once it was fully arranged. So that was all reasonably positive, it seemed, but that meeting took place following Pompeo visiting the Arctic Council. And Pompeo was somewhat more bullish at that event. So let's have a quick look at some of the things that he said there. He said the Arctic has become an arena for power and for competition, and the eight Arctic states must adapt to this new future. He said this is part of a very familiar pattern. He went on to criticise China. Beijing attempts to develop critical infrastructure using Chinese money, Chinese companies and Chinese workers, in some cases to establish a permanent Chinese security presence. Well, in fact, that's actually not the case, or at least there's no evidence that that's the case, so he's going to have to demonstrate that. But anyway, he went on to attack China in greater detail, and then he came on to Russia itself. And then there's Russia, he said. Russia illegally insists other nations request permission to pass through the northern sea route along its coast, expressing territorial ambitions just as violently as it did in Ukraine. So this is the kind of rhetoric that was coming out of him at the Arctic Council meeting. Clearly, the Arctic is going to become an issue. It's no longer about scientific discovery. It's about military matters now. That's increasingly been the case over the last few years. But he's basically putting his flag in the ground there and absolutely determined to push forward with that type of rhetoric. Then he was supposed to head off to Germany yesterday, but he cancelled that trip because he decided he would go to Baghdad amid, as the NPR here reporting, amid rising tensions with Iran. So this was an unscheduled visit. He cancelled the plans to meet Angela Merkel in Germany. Yesterday when this was announced that he had cancelled this plan, it was just saying that there was some kind of international security issue that he had to go and deal with. Well, this is apparently what it was that he wanted to deal with. I wanted to go to Baghdad, he said, to speak with the leadership there, to assure them that we stood ready to continue to ensure that Iraq is a sovereign, independent nation. So why does he need to do that unless they're preparing for something? So there seems to be double standards going on here, Brian, with Pompeo on one hand and Lavrov meeting, shaking hands, coming out of that meeting saying it was a positive meeting, but within a few hours of that, making really pretty aggressive statements with respect to China and Russia, then cancelling a meeting with Germany to fly off to Iraq to assure Iraq that their sovereignty would be protected. Under what circumstances? Well, where's the threat to their sovereignty at this point?
Well, I think this is the thing that's being created. This is intimidation that's been labelled as such, and the agenda is to try and foment yet more trouble in the Middle East in order to go against Iran. And Bolton has been quoted in the media of saying that his solution to Iran is to bomb Iran. There's quite a lot of comment on that. So is he lining up to do that?
Good question. So, well, good news because he's in Britain today. Will we find out any more? I doubt it. But he's here today to give the annual Margaret Thatcher lecture at the Centre for Policy Studies. And he's going to meet some British government officials as well. Perhaps he'll be meeting Mark Sedwell. We'll find that out later. But anyway, this was the US ambassador to the UK tweeting out, looking forward to welcoming Secretary Pompeo tomorrow, that's today, for his first UK visit. Full range of important meetings with our British counterparts, and the Secretary will deliver the Margaret Thatcher lecture on the special relationship. That's what's important. Okay, let's move on then to Syria. And Jeremy Hunt was saying this morning, I'm deeply concerned by the escalation in military action by Russia and the Syrian regime in Idlib. And I'm sure he is, because, of course, it's his tamed terrorists that are under threat here. He went on to say this has included horrifying reports of attacks on schools, hospitals and first responders, as well as the use of barrel bombs for the first time in seven months. So we're getting the same rhetoric with respect to schools and hospitals as we had over Aleppo, for example, Homs as well. And first responders are getting it, apparently. Well, of course, what first responders could he be talking about there? That would be the White Helmets, who we've demonstrated are deeply embedded, linked, working with possibly our terrorists themselves. So it's pretty clear that why he would be upset about that. Well, not just him, because here is Relief Web as another example. Apocalyptic scenario beginning in Syria with 77 killed, over 150,000 displaced. And they're saying in the past 72 hours has been a surge in airstrikes, barrel bomb attacks and artillery strikes in Idlib and Hama, Syria. At least 77 civilians have been killed, over 150,000 displaced in the past 7 days. Most cities in northern Hama are almost completely evacuated. Well, one of the things that Jeremy Hunt went on to say was that the Syrians and the Russians must also remember that any future use of chemical weapons in Syria would be met with a swift and appropriate response. So we have heard through connections in Syria and through Vanessa Bailey that in fact the so-called rebels are in a position to deploy chemical weapons at any point. So again, once again, we're in the same old narrative of blaming any potential chemical weapons. Hunt ready to blame any potential chemical weapons attacks on the Syrians and the Russians with no evidence, whereas there is evidence already of chemical weapons being in the hands of the so-called rebels. Now, where's the latest activity taking place? Well, it's in this part of the country here. Nabuta is the one that is being tweeted out by various Syrians at the moment, and there is a little bit of footage showing the fact that, well, they're describing it as liberated Nabuta, and I think that's probably how most Syrians see that. So as you can see, certainly no people left in the area, no terrorists left in the area, no insurgents. So good luck to them. I hope that this this Idlib campaign goes suitably well and they can manage to clear the last of the foreign insurgents out of the country.
Yeah, for some stability.
Yes.
Well, fake news. We're constantly being warned to be on the lookout for fake news. And I was just fascinated by this Guardian report. Here's the big headline. 241 million Europeans may have received Russian-linked disinformation. Research says malign actors online try to craft individual narrative for each EU state. You could almost get the impression the person who's written that's had a few glasses of wine. It's late in the evening. Let's get some rhetoric going. But 241 million Europeans may have received Russian-linked disinformation. Well, let's have a look at what The Guardian had to report. It said this, around half of all Europeans could have been exposed to disinformation promoted by social media accounts linked to Russia before the European elections, an analysis suggests. Evidence of 6,700 so-called bad actors posting enough content to reach up to 241 million users was discovered by researchers examining the scale of the threat. There was no all-purpose content, but locally created material was being amplified to craft a narrative for each EU member state, according to the study of a 10-day period from the 1st to the 10th of March. The report's authors found specific evidence of malign actors seeking to shape specific news development in Europe, including the debate over whether the Commons should back Theresa May's Brexit deal, during which divisive content was actively spread. So it all looks pretty powerful stuff. Let's add this bit in. The company that produced the research, online security firm Safeguard Cyber, said it had a database of more than 500,000 known troll and bot accounts and had confidence of their Russian links, although this could not be independently verified by The Guardian. Mm. So in The Guardian's article, after running with a headline of 241 million Europeans may have received Russian-linked disinformation, we find that actually there's no evidence there at all. And I think we're going to have to label this story fake news by The Guardian. And if anybody would like to take it up, the journalist who wrote it is Daniel Boffey. Daniel Boffey, I think he was probably having a good time there in Brussels because that's where he's based. He runs a headline accusing the Russians of interfering with 241 million people. And then in his own article, he admits actually there isn't any evidence that he's seen to support that. Mm. Do you think we could get a job where you're paid for that sort of material, Mike?
It's a good question.
It would be good, wouldn't it? Well, in case you think we want to end there, let's just bring in the company. Here's Safeguard Cyber. I had a close look at these individuals. I can't really see where their expertise comes from. But we've got Jim Suffoletti and Ottavio Freire. I tried to read more on both of them, but actually less is more because those two short paragraphs are all you can get. So there we are. It was the Russians, but nobody's prepared to put up the evidence to prove that it was the Russians. But we should believe it because it was The Guardian.
Well, look, we can rest assured that the situation is only going to get better, Brian, because here is Full Fact, our favourite fact-checking organisation. And they announced yesterday that they, along with what they describe as international partners, are receiving a grant from Google as part of the Google AI Impact Challenge. They've apparently been chosen from more than 2,600 entrants globally. And so they have been working, apparently, on automated fact-checking since 2013. They've been doing this with two organisations, Checkadoo and Africa Check, and they've built technologies used across three continents, and they're working to roll them out to 50 organisations worldwide. And so over the next 3 years, with the funding from Google, they're going to use artificial intelligence to dramatically improve and scale global fact-checking efforts, working with international experts to define how AI could transform this work, developing new tools and deploying and evaluating them. And they're going to work with media outlets, civil society, platforms and public policy makers worldwide to help them understand how AI can help people decide what information to trust and bring the benefit of automatic fact-checking tools to everyone. So I think we can rest assured that it doesn't matter that The Guardian was not able to independently verify anything that they published in their story, because if they can't do it, Full Facts AI is going to do that so in imminent future.
A robot had already checked that story.
Well, apparently all the disinformation is coming from Russian bots, but now they're going to deploy their own bots to demonstrate
to sort their bots out.
Correct.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a robot war. There you go. Anyway, yes,
right,
what can
I'm
we
speechless
say?
At yeah. this point.
Well, look, let's come back to the illustrious Mark Sedwill. Now, he has been getting quite a hammering in the press over the last few days. We'll come on to that in a second. But I just wanted to highlight this. Now, we pushed this out on Thursday. Mark Sedwill, we reminded people that he is head of the Cabinet Office, National Security Advisor. John Bolton's the US National Security Advisor, so that makes him the equivalent. Do you think they're of the same mind? I suspect they might be. But anyway, National Security Advisor, he's head of the civil service. He's effectively king of the United Kingdom. But we discovered something else over the last couple of days that puts another little bit of icing on this cake. He's sitting on the throne there quite appropriately because he is king of the UK. But let's focus on this bit, National Security Advisor. Well, in fact, being National Security Advisor, he is effectively in charge of the security services on an operational level. But it seems not just on an operational level. So let's have a look at this. Here's MI5, MI6, GCHQ. And they are funded, at least in part, through the Single Intelligence Account. This is an instrument, as it's described, to make sure that these organizations get funded appropriately. And it turns out that Mark Sedwill, in fact, is in charge of the single intelligence account. So he's not only in charge of them operationally, he's in charge of the money. This is what he has to say. I am the principal accounting officer for the SIA in line with the responsibility assigned to me in managing public money. My role is to ensure that the SIA operates effectively and efficiently in support of national security policies, aims and objectives. So this absolutely does make him chief spook.
It's just incredible. He's got an empire here which few people understand. We're only starting to get glimpse into it. He's got the money and he controls the money. He audits himself to his entire satisfaction. This man is immensely dangerous, particularly when we know that Theresa May is acting as if she's been brainwashed by a cult. Don't take my word for it. That's a trained psychologist is pointing out their concerns about Theresa May's behaviour. And this man is boasting that Theresa May is so vacuous, he had to come in and tell her what to do.
Well, we'll come on to that in a second, but it's a good point you make there that he's auditing himself. We'll come on to that. Keep that in mind, because we'll come on to that in a second as well. But let's just briefly have a look at some of the media coverage over the last few days. Some people agree with us, Brian. Here's a headline from the commentator, Gavin Williamson, an innocent man. We believe he's an innocent man. Many others seem to be taking that view as well. The Express and Star also expressing scepticism, because this is the Reckon MP asking for Mark Sedwill to publish the Williamson report. He wants to see the evidence. So there seems to be quite a bit of scepticism building over this. So a top civil servant ordered to hand over proof Gavin Williamson was guilty of leaking secret meeting after ministers sacking. So this is a committee of MPs now asking for the same. Then we had the Mail here, dark side of Prime Minister's softly spoken cabinet enforcer. This is Andrew Pearce talking about Sedwill. Here's the Times, Sir Mark Sedwill profile, cabinet secretary earned PM's gratitude apparently. So the Times, of course, giving a positive sort of retort to this. And then we had Richard Littlejohn over the weekend with this article, this preening Sir Humphrey Appleby needs to be cut down to size. Richard Littlejohn and Cabinet Secretary Sir Mark Sedwill. Now, I just wanted to highlight, go through this a little bit, because he makes some really excellent points. He says, Sir Humphrey Appleby, played brilliantly by the late Nigel Hawthorne in Anthony Jay and Jonathan Lynn's superb BBC series Yes Minister, is everyone's idea of the archetypal senior civil servant. He would use a mixture of guile, flattery and low cunning to bend politicians to his will. Whitehall insiders agreed it was an accurate portrayal of the modus operandi employed by permanent secretaries. When the wildly successful series and its sequel, Yes, Prime Minister, were first broadcast, civil servants began to model themselves on Sir Humphrey, adopting his mannerisms and vocabulary. Yet while Appleby pulled the strings, he was careful always to maintain the pretense that the politicians were in charge. No such restraint appears to apply to Sir Humphrey's real-life modern incarnation, Sir Mark Sedwill. Sedwill is not a man given to false modesty or respecting the opinions of democratically elected ministers. He treats cabinet members with undisguised contempt and takes decisions without consulting them. Effectively, he runs a government within the government, formulating policies and presenting them to the PM as a fait accompli. Woe betide anyone who crosses him. Sedwill's threat was made in January. He then goes on to talk about Gavin Williamson. He says Sedwill's threat was made in January after he and Gavin Williamson crossed swords over the defence budget. Well, in fact, we believe that they crossed swords over EU defence union, but that's for another day. Littlejohn goes on to say, but his account certainly seems to have the ring. This is Williamson's account, certainly seems to have the ring of truth about it. Sedwill has a reputation in which he revels for bullying ministers. His overbearing behaviour is apparent at Number 10's morning meetings, where he is said to push people aside to secure the seat next to Mrs May. Sedwill first spotted May's vacuity when she was Home Secretary and set about filling it. May was little more than his glove puppet. From what I can gather, the same now applies in Downing Street. May takes more notice of her civil servants than her cabinet colleagues. So that is what Littlejohn had to say. So I think that's pretty hard-hitting. Now, let's have a look at what Veterans for Britain was saying. A little-known fact about Mark Sedwill is his unrecorded meetings with the head of the Electoral Commission at a time the latter was pursuing serious allegations against Leave groups and ignoring offences by Remain campaigners, unannounced at the time, but revealed by an FOI later. So is there anywhere that this guy doesn't have his fingers? This is a very interesting thing. And thank you very much to the person who reminded us of this earlier on, because Mark Sedwell, was in the Home Office when Theresa May was Home Secretary. And he was giving evidence here to the Home Affairs Committee about the loss of 114 documents with respect to child abuse. So he was involved to some degree with the disappearance of the Dickens dossier and other child abuse files while Theresa May was Home Secretary. Let's just have a little listen to a bit of the
dialogue
that he gave during that evidence session.
I'm concerned, frankly, about the 114, and I'm concerned about all material that we can't find.
So let's go back a second, sorry. We're all concerned about it, that's why I asked you.
Yeah.
Did you tell the Home Secretary, when you finished your report, that 114 files, some of them which may have been relevant to the inquiry that you have asked an unnamed person to conduct, a report of which she never saw, but relied on your obviously excellent judgment in telling her that you regarded this as something that was a matter for you, you didn't tell her then that 114 files had gone missing?
I don't recall doing so, and I don't imagine I would. I went through with her the broad conclusions of the report and the broad process that we had followed, and of course the investigator concluded that he didn't believe that he hadn't seen any evidence that there was any material within the scope of his inquiry, so including those files that had been inappropriately destroyed or removed.
But
and so it was at that level.
Do you know who authorised the removal of these files or the destruction of these
files? No, I don't. And this is the issue with the 114, Mr. Chairman. The most of these files were probably destroyed because the kinds of topics that they covered would have been subject to the normal file destruction procedures that were in place at that time. But they can't be confirmed to have been destroyed because there isn't a proper log of what was destroyed and what wasn't.
So there wasn't a proper log of what was or wasn't destroyed. Now, later on in the evidence, he was asked how he knew that there were 114 files. And the reason was because on the database, the titles of those files were there. But he was basically suggesting that he had never read those files because they were lost. So he can't possibly know what was in them. And so he doesn't actually know whether it was appropriate that those files would have been destroyed or should have been destroyed as during the normal process, or whether they fell into a category of file which should have been destroyed. So I question whether that evidence was truthful under those circumstances. During the rest of the evidence that he was giving, Nicola Blackwood asked, the Home Secretary yesterday announced a non-statutory overarching inquiry, that was going to be headed at that time by Elizabeth Butler Sloss, but of course she didn't keep that job for very long, Brian, did she? Because links were discovered between her and Leon Britton, who was potentially going to be a subject of the.
She'd socialised with him, I think. That was a problem.
Will you be setting some kind of deadline? He was asked, and he said, I think everybody agrees justice delay is delayed is justice denied, and for many people, justice has been delayed for an entire generation. Her inquiry is not going to be pursuing individual cases. I'm sure she'll want to hear cases of that kind to help illuminate her work. But fundamentally, the purpose of the inquiry, as the Home Secretary has set out, is to look at the system and how the system failed those vulnerable children. So it's all about the system. We're saying this in practice now, of course, because as the inquiry has gone on via a couple of other heads of the inquiry, clearly they're not interested in the truth. We know that, Brian.
No, they said that they needed to manage, that was the word, to manage accusations of abuse from within Westminster. That was going to be managed. So this is not about finding who the guilty people were, who was abusing children and dealing with these people. It's simply going to be a narrative to say, well, we made some mistakes, but we've we've now changed the systems and we won't make these mistakes in the future. But fascinating to see Mr. Sedwill interviewed by Keith Vaz, because of course a little while ago we were trying to report on what was happening as a result of the allegations against Mr. Vaz, which was to do with a video which supposedly involved rent boys and I believe some drugs. But we then discovered that within Westminster, MPs had voted that if they were accused of a demeanour, that should go through a secret inquiry. And as a result, it wasn't possible as a journalist to get any information as to what had happened to Mr. Vaz. So a lot of time's gone on. It's fascinating to see him is the man who's asking the questions of Mr. Sedwill. And Mr. Sedwill, very smooth in what he's saying, but if you actually analyse what he's saying, it doesn't stack up.
No, it doesn't stack up. And,
no.
And we need to remember that Mark Sedwill, when he was giving this evidence, was working within the Home Office. Theresa May was the Home Secretary at the time. As Richard Littlejohn said, he recognised her vacuity. He became her puppet master at that point. He then moves with her. When she becomes Prime Minister, he moves into the Cabinet Office. He's still her puppet master. But while he was at the Home Office, he had Ollie Robbins working with him. He brought Ollie Robbins into the Cabinet Office when he went. And Ollie Robbins and he, of course, have been driving the whole Brexit process from the beginning. So if there's anybody that needs to understand why the Brexit process has ended up at the point that it is, then begin with Mark Sedwill and Ollie Robbins, who have been colleagues for many, many years. So finally, my final point on this, Brian, is to ask the question, how can one man wear so many hats? How can he possibly do the job? Now, if anybody that's watched Yes Minister or Yes Prime Minister, you know that, of course, Sir Humphrey never wanted to give away any power that he'd been given. But the question was he actually able to carry all the roles and do all the jobs? I don't see how this guy can possibly be giving proper oversight, yeah, even to the budget of the security services when he's got so much else to do.
Well, I would say he's a puppet in his own right, and the key is to find out who is the handler of Mark Sedwill. But I think there's a lot more of this story going to run, and I think UK Column is entitled to say that this story has only reached mainstream media reporting because of the early reports we did highlighting that something was badly wrong. And in particular, although we've disagreed with a lot of things that Gavin Williamson has done, we stood up and said Gavin Williamson is telling the truth, and we need to have a closer look at Mr. Sedwill. So there we are, the irony of Sedwill interviewed by Keith Vaz. But the media doing its best to keep child abuse out of the Westminster spotlight. So here's the Daily Mail on Cube. Police probing historic child sex abuse and exploitation in Rotherham arrest 38 men and 2 women in 2 months following the claims of 11 victims. And there's an inset advert almost, the British towns and cities where Asian sex gangs were exposed. So even though we've got thousands of victims and this has been going on for year after year, clearly Asian gangs have been involved. We see this pattern replicated across the country with other paedophile gangs. We have the reports of abuse from people within Westminster. We have Metropolitan Police officers blowing the whistle on the cover-up of the abuse of children by members of the establishment and the political elite in Westminster. There is no evidence of anybody other than the Asians. And of course, Mark Sedwill there, unfortunately, those files have been lost, and we just don't know what's happened there. So child abusers, according to the mainstream media in UK, are Asian. The majority are Asian. No child abuse in Westminster. And of course, the government is running a child abuse inquiry to its own satisfaction, which won't actually look at child abuse in Westminster. If this was comedy, we'd be doing extremely well. But what we're really doing is, I think, trying to show the wider world the state of politics in UK at the moment. And it seems to me, Mike, that nothing the British government says on any subject whatsoever is to be trusted. and people watching from America or South Africa or France or Germany, all the other places that we have viewers, our overall message is something deeply wrong inside British politics. And we have a government of occupation. We don't even know at the moment who's running the government. We'll end there.
Well, just before we do, can I just mention that there are still very few day tickets available for AV10, which is taking place this weekend. Brian will be speaking at that, as will David Ellis, Patrick Henningsen, and a bunch of other great speakers. And also, of course, this year, for the first year, Ian Crane is running a live stream of that, which is a pay-per-view. You can get all the details at alternativeview.co.uk, but there's still some day tickets if you want to come and meet at the hotel.
Yeah, it will be a fantastic event. That's it for today. Thank you very much for joining us. If you like what we do and would like to help the UK column, then please donate and or take out a subscription. We can only do what we do with your financial support. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.